We are very lucky to have John Burnside as a poet in residence this year. Not just luck, I mean, it's just brilliant of Chloe that to have got him for it. It's a real achievement. And he's the only poet ever to have won both the T.S. Eliot and the Forward Prize for the same book, Black Cat Burn. Yes, quite right, too. And if you haven't got it already, you can go and buy it at the back afterwards. He's amazingly produced, very prolific. He's produced 12 collections and 7 novels and 3 memoirs. Many of you will know A Lie About My Father, but there's 2 others as well. He is an amazing writer, and Gillian Clark, who's much known and loved in this festival, when she chaired the T.S. Eliot, she described him, his work, as haunting, and it wouldn't be the first word I would choose for your work, but it should have been to be admired and praised by Gillian, to my mind, is high praise indeed. And he is a remarkable writer, as you know, I hope, and if you don't, you must go and read his books, and you will sense from his choices today. I mean, I just want to quote one thing for you from a poem of his called Coy in The Light Trap. So it's such a wonderful line, and it says so much. The trick, he said, is to create a world from nothing. The trick is in the making, not the made. And that says a great deal, I think, about his poetry. And John, can we hand over to your first choices? How did you make the choices, brother?
Well, I gave myself some rules because there's so many to choose from. I think if everyone fantasizes about doing Desert Island Discs, I think if I ever did that, I would be just swamped by things that I liked.
Yeah.
So I made some rules, as such as I would if I was doing something to do music. So I only chose 20th century work, which rules out a huge body of work, which I imagine you would all know in certain English anyway. I didn't choose any work that had been translated, although in fact, one of the biggest influences on me when I was beginning to write was actually Spanish poetry. Spanish poetry kind of liberated me from a certain kind of sense of an alien lyric in English. American poetry and Spanish poetry in particular made me feel that there's something other than Rupert Brooke to use as a model. And I remember in my Catholic working class school, we used to have assemblies, and that was one of the few kids who was actually interested in doing this kind of thing. So I'd be put on stage and I would stand there and say, if I should die, think only this of me. If there's a corner of some foreign field, it is forever England. Because that's in my back of my mind.
With the gestures.
Oh, I'd do the gestures, yeah. Rehearse them. But at the back of my mind, I'm saying, well, I'm a Scottish pacifist. So this poem is not really real home to me. But also formally, it felt like part of a culture that wasn't really mine. And that's resolved somewhat now, that when you're 14 or 13 or 15 or whatever, you feel very strongly things like class differences and national differences. So, as I say, I could have chosen old Spanish poetry because Spanish poetry, the cadences of Spanish poetry, informed my earlier work, certainly. But those were the 2 rules. Nothing in translation, nothing from before the 20th century.
And how about biographical? I mean, you say that you didn't have books at home.
No, we had no books.
To what extent is this any part of this collection this morning going to trace your life, your mental development?
Well, the first poem is a poem that I wrote. My music teacher was an incredible man called Norman Edmonds, and he was around 70 when he finally left the school, but he kept on working. He was the only non-Catholic in my Catholic school, and he was the only kind of liberal mind around me, really, I think, in the school. And he was a drama and a music teacher, and he was the one who actually arranged these events where we all sang in the choir and we recited poems. And he kind of loosened that up a bit, so we got away from Rupert Brooke so I could do Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights occasionally and things like that. But he very much liked the idea of learning poems by heart. And that kind of was the first thing that informed me. So he would give me things to read. He was my music teacher as well, my piano teacher. Mm. My father didn't want a piano in the house, so it took the intervention of a parish priest to get a piano in the house. Then he wouldn't let me practice. My lovely music teacher, he would arrange my music lessons as the last of his session on a Saturday. And I'd stay there for hours afterwards with him, playing the piano and talking and listening to music. And he would lend me books, and I would actually wrap them up in paper so that I wouldn't damage them, because they were all very good, in very good condition. And because books were precious to us, we didn't have any. So he was this wonderful influence on me when I was in middle school and beyond.
And did he include any contemporary poetry in what he introduced you to or not?
Well, I guess maybe it was contemporary to him. not that side to me. But no, Edward Thomas was a favourite, and Hardy. Mm-hmm. And the first poem is by Thomas Hardy. And this is the poem called The Self-Unseeing. I can't remember it anymore, but I'll have to read it from the page. The Self-Unseeing. Here is the ancient floor, foot-worn and hollowed and thin. Here was the former door where the dead feet walked in. She sat here in her chair, smiling into the fire. He who played stood there, bowing it higher and higher. Childlike, I danced in a dream. Blessings emblazoned that day. Everything glowed with a gleam, yet we were looking away.
To his wife, presumably, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's a memory of childhood, and I think it's also what it captures for me is that sense of, as we live through an experience, we're not paying enough attention to it. I can't remember which Roman philosopher said, we actually need two lives. First, we live our lives, and then we go back again so we can actually appreciate them. Mm. You know, so pay attention to what's happening. And I think it's just that feeling of when things have gone, your parents or your wife, your family, whoever, you look back and you think, I didn't appreciate, I didn't pay enough attention, I didn't stop and think, this is fleeting, I'll lose this.
That's really interesting, because if you're around on Sunday, come and hear Ko Eun, the Korean poet, because he absolutely believes that we are leading successive lives, and what you're saying is very sympathetic to how he lives his life. Sorry. Interjection. On. Mm. Your next choice?
Well, the first poet that made me think I'd like to write poetry was Marianne Moore. And I've not chosen the poem that inspired me. I realise a lot of my poems are rather long that I've chosen. I like the longer thing. But Marianne Moore's Steeplejack poem was the first poem I ever read. I thought, I want to do this. You know, because my father said, you can't do that. It's not, you're the wrong kind of person to write poetry. That's kind of the wrong paying person to do almost anything.
Go and read A Lie About My Father.
So this is a poem by Marianne Moore called A Graveyard. Man looking into the sea, taking the view from those who have as much right to it as you have to it yourself. It is a human nature to stand in the middle of a thing. But you cannot stand in the middle of this. The sea has nothing to give but a well-excavated grave. The firs stand in a procession, each with an emerald turkey fruit at the top, reserved as their contours, saying nothing. Repression, however, is not the most obvious characteristic of the sea. The sea is a collector, quick to return a rapacious look. There are others besides you who have worn that look, whose expression is no longer a protest. The fish no longer investigate them, for their bones have not lasted. Men lower nets, unconscious of the fact that they are desecrating a grave, and row quickly away, the blades of the oars moving together like the feet of water spiders, as if there were no such thing as death. The wrinkles progress upon themselves in a phalanx, beautiful under networks of foam, and fade breathlessly while the sea rustles in and out of the seaweed. The birds swim through the air at top speed, committing catcalls as heretofore. The tortoise shell scourges about the feet of the cliffs, in motion beneath them and the ocean, under the pulsation of lighthouses and noise of bellboys. Advances as usual, looking as if it were not that ocean in which dropped things are bound to sink, in which, if it turn and twist, is neither with volition nor consciousness.
Thank you very much for that and for Marianne Moore. I must say, I don't think I'll ever look at the sea again without thinking of that. That's a wonderful poem, isn't it? Next, Robert Frost.
The next one is Robert Frost, and this is a theme of that I'm very much interested in, is the animal encounter, the human-animal encounter. And, it's rarer and rarer for human beings to actually come into close proximity to wild animals, and there's always that thrill of meeting a wild animal or wild animals. And I have a great game I play with my kids when they're driving, say, in Scotland. I suddenly say, deer. And they immediately stop playing with their Game Boys and drop them on the floor and actually look out the window, because if there's one thing that will interrupt them from their computer games, it's the prospect of an animal. So that's a tip for anybody who's got small children. If you want to stop them from playing Game Boy, just pretend there's an animal nearby. This is a great poem by Robert Frost. It's called Two, Look at Two. Love and forgetting might have carried them a little further up the mountainside with night so near, but not much further up. They must have halted soon in any case with thoughts of a path back. How rough it was with rock and washout and unsafe in darkness. When they were halted by a tumbling wall with barbed wire binding, they stood facing this, spending what onward impulse they still had in one last look the way they must not go. On up the failing path, where if a stone or earth slide moved at night, it moved itself. No footstep moved it. This is all, they sighed. Good night to the woods. But no, not so. There was more. A doe from round a spruce stood looking at them across the wall, as near the wall as they. She saw them in their field, they her in hers. The difficulty of seeing what stood still, like some upended boulder split in two, was in her clouded eyes. They saw no fear there. She seemed to think that two thus must, that thus they were safe. Then, as if they were something that, though strange, she could not trouble her mind with too long, she sighed and passed unscared along the wall. This, then, is all. What more is there to ask? But no, not yet. A snort to bid them wait. A buck from round the spruce stood looking at them across the wall, as near the wall as they. This was an antlered buck of lusty nostril, not the same doe come back into her place. He viewed them quizzically with jerks of head, as if to ask, why don't you make some motion or give some sign of life? Because you can't. I doubt if you're as living as you look. Thus, till he had them almost feeling dared to stretch a proffering hand and a spell breaking, then he too passed unscared along the wall. Two had seen two, whichever side you spoke from. Must be all. It was all. Still they stood, a great wave from it going over them, as if the earth, in one unlooked-for favor, had made them certain earth returned their love.
The nice thing I think about these sessions is that they certainly introduced me to poems that I didn't know. I mean, I thought I knew Hardy and Marianne Moore and Robert Frost pretty well, but all three of those poems I'd never come across before. So thank you very much, John. From now on, we are plunging, I suspect for most of us, into different waters. And it's, I think everything from now on is from the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't plan that, actually. But it's happened.
John worked in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, for a while, yeah.
And so you're deeply steeped in the States.
Well, this is where I... Before we had internet and before English bookshops had coffee and sofas, I used to, you know, used to stand there looking rather...
We don't even have bookshops now.
No, exactly.
Sadly, apart from
stand
here.
Stand there looking guilty, kind of, you know, should I read this book? It's got a risque title. Someone might see me. But I used to go into places like Capitalist Bookstore on Camino Real, and you'd sit in a sofa and get a huge pile of books and just go through them and choose which one you wanted. And then I would pack two cases whenever I went over to the States. And the inner case would hold my clothes, etc., and the outer case would be empty, as it were. And then I'd pack the outer case full of books and music and, you know, because I couldn't get the jazz I wanted in those days, and clothes and things, and bring them back. So I'd come back with all these treasures. And that's where I first found, say, Jory Graham, for example, or several of the poets that I really most admire now, because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have Amazon. So that's how I found most of the poems that we're going to look at next. As well.
Lovely. Well, let's go on.
Well, this one's by Robinson Jeffers, who is considered something of a curmudgeon. I don't think so, but... He grew up in central and southern California, and that area kind of ranged up and down before all the development happened, like around Carmel, for example. And he was appalled by the damage that was being done to his local landscape, as it were, by development. So he became quite a hardline eco-critical poet, if you like, working from about the 20s to the 60s, I think it was. I'm very bad with dates. Quite bad with time and date, so a poem for me is just as a poem. It's not a historical artifact. And this is a poem of his. I love this poem because I went recently with my wife to our lawyer to make a new will, and the lawyer said, what do you want to do about funeral stuff? And I said, well, I want a sky burial. And my wife said, what? A sky burial is where you get, like in Tibet, they put you on a pile of twigs and leave you there, and the vultures and the foxes and stuff come and eat you. I thought it was a great idea. Well, nice to be, you know, regenerated and recycled. But then my wife was saved by the fact the lawyer told me that it was actually illegal in this country to have a sky burial.
Oh, yes.
So this poem comes as close as I could think to the most satisfying way of disposing of one's corpse afterwards. So it's called Vulture. I had walked since dawn and lay down to rest on the bare hillside above the ocean. I saw through half-shut eyelids a vulture wheeling high up in heaven. And presently it passed again, but lower and nearer, its orbit narrowing. I understood then that I was under inspection. I lay death still and heard the flight feathers whistle above me and make their circle and come nearer. I could see the naked red head between the great wings, bared downward, staring. I said, my dear bird, we are wasting time here. These old bones will still work. They are not for you. But how beautiful he looked, gliding down on those great sails. How beautiful he looked, veering away in the sea light over the precipice. I tell you solemnly that I was sorry to have disappointed him. To be eaten by that beak and become part of him, to share those wings and those eyes, what a sublime end of one's body. What an ensconcement. What a life after death.
Of course, that's exactly what Parsis believe. They put out their bodies to be pecked and to be eaten by vultures. And rather tragically, Mumbai is a big Parsi population. And with modern consumable food and things, vultures in Mumbai no longer will eat the Parsi bodies. Tragic, isn't it? And a serious problem for them, and they don't know what to do about it. Meanwhile, back at the poems, Weldon Keyes?
Yeah, Weldon Keyes is he's one of those wonderful creatures of mystery. He didn't produce a huge amount of poetry in his lifetime, rather short lifetime. He wrote some great poems and some not so great poems. He was a good critic of jazz and film. He drove his car one day to a bridge and left the car there, and no one ever saw him again. So people assumed that he went to the bridge and jumped off. But there's no evidence whatsoever that he did that. So I like to think of him still probably wandering around the earth, listening to the latest things in jazz and making private notes and, you know, and writing maybe more poems. One day we'll find them. This is a very short poem. It's very poignant for me about... I remember I first read it when at that age when I could still conceive of the possibility of pleasure. it struck me very poignant at that time. Weldon Keyes, The Smiles of the Bathers. The smiles of the bathers fade as they leave the water. And the lover feels sadness fall as it ends, as he leaves his love. The scholar, closing his book as the midnight clock strikes, is hollow and old. The pilot's relief on landing is no release. These perfect and private things walling us in have imperfect and public endings. Water and wind and flight, remembered words and the act of love are but interruptions. And the world, like a beast, impatient and quick, waits only for those who are dead. No death for you. You are involved.
You mentioned that he was a jazz critic. I mean,
and film.
But how much do you think jazz informs your poetry?
I think actually, I started listening to jazz when I was a youngish teenager, actually. By luck, more than anything else, was my father's record collection consisted of three records. One was Al Jolson, that kind of mammy stuff, awful. Well, it's kind of well done, but and two by Mario Lanza.
My father.
I met a neighbour who had jazz records. I don't know where they got some of them from because they were pretty hard to get in those days, blues and jazz. And these days I'd probably be taken away and he'd be arrested. But I used to go around his house and he'd play me records for ages. And a solitary man who, his wife had died earlier. But these days I think a 12-year-old going around to this strange man's house probably would be put into care or something. But he played me a lot of this. And also then I met, not the parish priest, the assistant, I forgot what it's called now, what's the assistant parish priest called? The curate? Whatever. Mm. And he was into jazz as well, also classical music. So I got to hear a lot of jazz earlier in my teens. But that was mostly a lot of it was traditional jazz and blues. And then I started hearing, more free-form jazz like bebop and cool jazz and free jazz. And I think that was when I was in college, I guess. And I wasn't writing then, I used to write poems to try and impress girls. That wasn't serious, But, listening to that made you think, yeah, it doesn't have to be this strict stuff. And also at the same time reading Spanish poetry and New American poetry, where we're counting syllables instead of very metrical forms. And I felt it was more native to who I was, what my voice was. So jazz certainly played a part in that. And probably rock music as well, to some extent, as well. The better rock music. I mean, not stuff that we just raise our heads to like this.
I must go. When I next read your poetry, which will be probably tomorrow, I will try and listen for, see whether the rhythms from... I've never sort of looked for them before.
They may not sound... It's the permission to be freer.
Yeah.
And to say, okay, if it's irregular, it doesn't mean it's formless.
Truly not.
Yeah.
Lovely. Meanwhile, back at your choices... I can't even read my own writing.
This is Georgia?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is one of the first books I discovered by this method of going into the bookshops in like Cupertino and Camino Real. I was sitting there going through these books, and suddenly I came across Jerry Graham's second book, actually. So that was 1990, I think, 1991. And thought, this is an amazing poet, and I got her first and second books. And what's great about this poem is that for the first time I felt there was a contemporary of mine somewhere in the world who had the same interest in what's now called eco-critical poetry or eco-critical writing, who was doing it in poetry rather than some kind of theoretical way, or what I think it was a kind of light green way, if you know what I mean, that kind of okay, right on greenness, which is a bit of a, it's been a bit of a stumbling block for genuine progress in, so I won't go on too long on my... But, you know, some of the right on greenness, and Germany is really an interesting place to be right now for this. They're kind of the need to be more radically green than actually we have been so far. And this is a poem in which is written by a woman about men trying to con nature, and she can see that they can't. And look for the word towards the end, pass. The word pass. In an American context, the word pass in this could only have previously been used in terms of black people trying to pass for whites, or maybe early on Jews trying to pass for Gentiles because of the, you know, racism. Jerry Graham, reading Plato. This is the story of a beautiful lie. What slipped through my fingers, your fingers. It's winter. It's far in the lifespan of man. Bareheaded, in a soiled shirt, speechless, my friend is making lures his hobby. Flies so small, he works with tweezers and a magnifying glass. They must be so believable, they're true feelers, antennae, quick and frantic as something drowning. His heart beats wildly in his hands. It is blinding, and who will forgive him in his tiny garden? He makes them out of hair, deer hair, because it's hollow and floats. Past death, past sight, this is his good idea, what drives the silly days together. Better than memory, better than love. Then they are done, a hook under each pair of wings, and it's spring, and the men wade out into the riverbed at dawn. Above, the stars still connect up their hungry animals. Soon they'll be satisfied and go. Meanwhile, upriver, downriver, imagine, quick in the air, in flesh, in a blue swarm of flies, our knowledge of the graceful deer skips easily across the surface. Dismembered, remembered, it's finally alive. Imagine the body they were all once a part of, these men along the lush green banks, trying to slip in and pass for the natural world.
Thank you, John. It always frustrates me in Desert Island Discs that the lovely choices, and I think that she's terribly good, Kirsty Young, but they never at the end of the piece of music remind you who it was by and what the title was. So just remind us of her again.
That was Jerry Graham. That was reading Plato. It's from her book, Erosion, second book.
I've never come across anybody who uses the lure as a metaphor. It's a wonderful metaphor, I think.
Beautiful,
and, yeah, absolutely terrific. Thank you very much indeed. On?
Yeah, well, who was at my yesterday workshop? You can leave now if you want. This is Lucy Brock-Broido, I'm afraid, for those of you who were... it's quite controversial, my choices were. This is a contemporary poet whom I've got to know at a distance, actually. Who is doing something that I think is quite different. And she actually wrote to me originally and said she thought we were both doing something similar. And she calls it feral poetry. Oh, sorry, is it English feral or feral?
Feral.
Feral. Feral. Yeah. Feral poetry. And I call it baroque. as in the imperfect pearl, which is more interesting than the perfect.
As in your workshop.
Yes, that's in the Baroque, yeah. And what I find interesting her is the way she renews her engagement with language by surprising us. And while there are lots of interesting allusions, which you think, oh, that's not, you shouldn't be alluding to that now. It's a very strange thing to do. But she leaves a lot for us to do, a lot of work for us to do. So I've chosen a shortish poem, because some of our longer ones are hard to read out to people who don't know anything about her at all. This is a rather beautiful short poem with an echo of Dylan Thomas, of course, in the title. It's Lucy Brought Broido a Girl Ago, as opposed to a grief ago, if you're a Thomas fan. No feeding on wisteria, no pitch burner traipsing into the nettled woods, no milk in metal cylinders, no buttering, no making small contusions on the page, but saying nothing no one has not said before, no milkweed blown across your pony coat, no burrs, no scent of juniper on your Jacobean mouth, no crush of ink or injury, no lacerating wish. Extinguish me from this. I was 16 for 20 years. By September, I will be a ghost. And flickering in unison with all the other fireflies in Appalachia, blinking in the swarm of it, and all at once, above and on a bare branch in a shepherd's sky, no dove. There is no thou to speak of.
For those of us who weren't at the workshop, tell us a bit more about Lucy Brock Broidel.
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 Broidel. Yeah, she was born in Pittsburgh a year after me. So must have been about 20 years ago.
So she's young.
She's young, yeah. Well, she's a lot younger than me in many ways. And she's published 3 books of poetry in all that time. And she's very, very punctilious and works very carefully and slowly. So there'll be something like a 7-year gap between each volume of poems. And as I say, what I find interesting about her is this: she's got an extraordinary depth of learning and wide range of allusion, but it's the way in which she will suddenly bring a word into the light. She'll find a word that we use every day and pick it out of the kind of riverbed, all glistening and sparkling and new. You think, oh, look how much I've missed about that word. Or she'll find a word that is very obscure and she'll bring it into ordinary speech and make it live there. And widen our sense of what the world is like, of vocabulary about the world. And surely it's important, I think, when all of the forces of power against us, the common people, as it were, are trying to limit our range of language, are trying to make us less wide-ranging in our perception and our speech, that poetry should say, no, it's subtler, it's richer, it's more complex than that. You know, rather than the soundbite and the advert, you know, and those kinds of things, we say, poetry says, no, we have to use the wide range of language and we have to look at the world really as it is. That's the only way we can not save it, but save ourselves in it.
That's wonderful. That just says everything about the importance of this festival and of the poetry we hear this week, really. Thank you, John. Now, sadly, this is going to be the last poem, but you'll have plenty of time to ask questions.
Well, this poem is by one of my favourite living poets, I want to kind of give my commendation, or what the right word is, to Chloe for trying to get him here. Hopefully we'll get here sometime. But we were very excited, because at one point we hoped he would be here. And we're very excited we'd be here together. So you would never have seen us. We'd be in the Prince of Wales for days. You know? This is a great poet, a really great poet, Robert Wrigley, and who is now published in the UK, thanks to Neil Astley, by Bodax. And, you know, I've been wanting to see his work in this country for years. Because he truly is one of the great American poets. It's a relatively recent poem called I Like the Wind. Oh, I should say maybe a little bit about him. He lives in Idaho. He's not from Idaho, but he moved there some years ago. And I occasionally have little experiences of animals or snow that I want to relay to him. For example, it snowed for it had 3 inches of snow in my yard one day. So I sent him a photograph of my yard with 3 inches of snow, and he sent me back a photograph of his yard with 5 feet of snow in it. And I told him once about, you know, glancing out the window of my car as I was driving along and seeing a wildcat, and he sent me a wonderful set of stories about bears that he'd recently encountered. I was lucky enough to commission him to write a poem for an anthology that Morris Reardon and I put together, and I knew what he'd write about. And he said, this is great, because I actually can go and see a bear, touch a bear, a grizzly bear, because the local area wardens had to bring in one of the bears that had a very badly impacted tooth, I think it was, some damage to its jaw anyway. So they tranquilized it and brought it in to have this work done, and they were going to release it afterwards. And Bob got to go in and touch a bear or a tiger or something like that. There's a movie where a blind woman, gets to touch a tiger. I thought, what a wonderful experience that would be. The rest of the movie was horrible, but that was a great moment. I like the wind. We are at or near that approximate line where a stiff breeze becomes or lapses from a considerable wind. And I like it here. The chimney smokes right angled from west to east, but still for brief intact stretches, the plush animal tails of their fires. I like how the stiffness rouses the birds right up until what's considerable sends them to shelter. I like how the morning's rain, having wakened the soil's raw materials, sends a root smell into the air around us, which the pine trees sway stately within. I like how the sun strains not to go down, how the horizon tugs gently at it, and how the distant grain elevator's shadow ripples over the stubble of the field. I like the bird feeder's slant and the dribble of its seeds. I like the cat's sleepiness as the breeze, then the wind, then the breeze keeps combing her fur. I like the body of the mouse at her feet. I like the way the apple core I tossed away has browned so quickly. There's much to be admired, as is the way the doe extends her elegant neck in its direction and the workings of her black nostrils too. I like the sound of the southbound truck blowing by, headed east. I like the fact that the dog is not barking. I like the arc of the house afloat on the Sea of March and the swells of the crop hills bedizened with sedillas of old snow. I like old snow. I like my lungs and their conversions to the gospel of spring. I like the wing of the magpie outheld as he probes beneath it for fleas or lice. That's especially nice. The last sun pinkening his underfeathers as it also pinks the dark when I close my eyes, which I like to do in the face of it. This stiff breeze that was, when I closed them, a considerable wind.
I really like that poem. Is it in the collection of Wrigley that you publish, Neil?
No, it's not in that one. Relatively new, yeah.
It's the next one.
It's
a lovely poem, I think. Well, I mean, you've introduced me to so many poets that we are very bad. I mean, apart from Chloe and Neil and this festival, as a nation, we're terribly badly informed about American poetry, aren't we? I mean,
so much
when Alicia Stallings was said to be in the running for the professor of poetry, I mean, very few people in this country knew her. I mean, another reason to be grateful for Neil and for Chloe and for this festival. I mean, but anyway, you've introduced me to a good half dozen poets that I will want to go back and read, and I suspect that goes for almost everybody in this room. Who would like to ask a question? Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for all the interviews. It's absolutely wonderful. In the friend of an ultimate poet, Lucy Boggle or something, you made a
Brock Broggle, yes.
Who was born a year after you. You made a sort of throwaway remark how you were, in fact, you were a lot older than her in many ways. what do you mean by that?
Can you hear at the back all right? Because we haven't got a mic, unfortunately. But you said, so I didn't get your name, sorry.
Charles.
Charles was asking whether John, being a year, he said, older than Lucy Brock Broyle, but not in fact, whether you would like to amplify that. And
well, I think the best thing to do is go on YouTube, and we did a kind of reading together. It was very bizarre. I was in Berlin at night, and she was in Boston in the daytime. But just look at her and me. She has hair that comes out like this, and she's like an elemental creature. And she's such a quick mind. She's always her mind's always darting around. And but she's, you know, if you're speaking to her, she takes everything you say in. But her mind is also darting around and making associations. So that when you say something to her, she comes back with something. What? Yes, of course. You know, and then she brought in, I don't think it wasn't on the YouTube recording, she brought in she has Maine Coon kittens all over her house. But anyway, it's just,
what are they?
A little oh, they're so cute. Little cats. Little cats.
Yes. Wild cats, are they?
No, it's a recognised breed. Oh. Mostly, I don't think there are many in the UK. They're mostly in the US. I'm sure there's a Maine Coon club somewhere in Britain.
Never heard of them.
They're very cute. They're very lovely. But anyway, it's just her energy and her life.
So you weren't actually saying something about your comparative experience of life?
Oh, no, I'm sure. Nothing to do with that, just my sheer exhaustion having two kids, two boys.
Another question? Sir?
I was wondering about your particular generation of Scottish poets.
So do I.
Oh.
I'm thinking of yourself, Robert Crawford, Ben Patterson, Kathleen Jamie, Robin Robertson, all very successful in different ways. And I think
Yeah. It's interesting you say that because the generation before mine was called the New Scottish Renaissance and was considered a really very rich generation of poets in terms of the world. I'm slightly outside that group in a sense because I left Scotland when I was 10 years old and my formative education happened in England, but over formative means. So I only came back to live in Scotland in 96. And I'm now living in Germany. And excuse me. I'm probably going to stay in Germany. But the previous generation had...
Better jazz.
Better jazz, yeah. And the previous generation had, if you allow a certain leeway to call it a generation... We had Donald McCaig, we had Sorley McLean and Gaelic. We had, I'll include McDermott because he's more or less. We had Ian Crichton-Smith, Sidney Goodsir Smith. And we had no women poets, that's interesting.
Lizzie Lockhead.
Well, no, she's in between, I think.
Yes,
bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you've got Liz Lockhead and others. Then you've got this generation which, if I'm classed as part of it, I'm probably the oldest of them, I think. And Patterson and Crawford and Jamie. I never write anything, for example, in Scots. I've never published anything in Scots, I don't think, because I lost my Scots when I left at the age of 10. They put me through English speaking board, and, you know, and I had to try and learn how to speak proper, like the Queen. And so I would sit there. And
didn't do a very good job, did they?
No, they did a terrible job of that. They got me. They denatured me as a Scot, but didn't make me into an English person. So I was somewhere in between. You know, I should probably live on the border. I should spend my whole life in Gretna Green or something.
Debatable lands.
Yeah, debatable. Very debatable in my case. But so I was kind of. I wish I could write in Scots, for example, but I would be a fraud for me to write in Scots because, you know, I've forgotten it. Although as a child, when I first came to England, the teacher would ask a question in class. I'd answer the question, point at me, I'd answer. I said no, and go to someone else who'd say exactly the same thing, but in proper English. So then I was sat in a room with a person who's trying to train me to speak and saying things like, my father's car is a Jaguar. My father didn't have a car at all. If he had a car, he probably sold it and gambled the money on the Derby. And, you know, all these things. I was kind of denatured. I think there's a kind of group of people who have got something in common. I have less in common with them than the rest of the people I think it was in that group. You know, Bill Herbert, for example, would have more in common with Robert Crawford and Kathy and Jamie. I think Robin Robertson is somewhat different too. He spent a lot of time away from Scotland. And he is from Aberdeen. Mm.
Angus McNeil? Angus McNeil?
Angus McNeil. Oh. Angus McNeil, yeah. He's writes in Gaelic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in English.
Oh, he writes in English too. Yes, yeah. Oh, he translates his own stuff into English, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know him a little. I'm Angus Peter Campbell, so a writer that I like more. I don't know if you know Angus Peter Campbell. His Gaelic name is unpronounceable. but he's a very, very, very interesting Gaelic poet.
And Angus McNeil's unspellable.
Yeah.
It's got more E's and A's and C's than anything else. Yeah. I'm so glad about your answer, John, because your absolutely reasonable and interesting questions made me feel terribly old, because the generation that you were talking about of Sawley MacLean and Norman McCaig and Eddie Morgan, yeah, I worked with in the 1970s, and they were all great friends. I loved Norman McCaig. He was just a wonderful man.
Yeah.
And Lizzie Lockhead is one of my oldest and dearest friends. And so you made me feel terribly old. But it was a good question, and it elicited a wonderful answer. Thank you, John.
The first reading I ever did, I arrived, and it was organised by a guy called Richard DeMarco, who was a legend, of course, in Edinburgh.
In the festival, yeah, yeah. He ran the festival, virtually, the Fringe.
That's right. And he said, I had the book out, which wasn't very good, it was my first book, and he said, oh, I want you to come and read. And I said, And he said, oh, come on and read, there'll be interesting people there, and some Portuguese poets are coming too. Oh, that'll be good. So I went, and I went to my event. The other readers with me were Sawley MacLean, Ian Crichton-Smith, and I think it was Norman McCaig.
Eddie Morgan?
No, he wasn't there.
No.
But just think, what? You know, it's like throwing a little lamb into the lion's den. They were very kind to me, especially Norman. Norman was always very... Norman's a great
friend
to me.
He's a gentleman, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Another final question, I think. Yes, you, madam. Question about the kind of green poetry that John was referring to.
Actually, what I was referring to was green policies that we need. although I do think that it's interesting that in this country, perhaps, there's been a debate recently about what they're calling nature writing, a term I don't like. It started with a rather vicious review of Robert McFarlane's work in the London Review of Books by, I think, Kathy and Jamie, am I saying? And, of course, you have to take that with a pinch of salt because they're probably the two...
Competitive.
Yeah, the competitors, they say. And I actually have an exercise I do with my creative writing students about criticism and competition. When you write a critique of your competitor, what does that actually mean? Unless you're praising them, of course. That was really unpleasant. It was very ad hominem. There was this idea of, you know, the white male out in the landscape is somehow privileged. And, well, a white middle class male. Well, I thought, well, you're a white middle class woman. Is that so much different? You know? But One other thing I think is, there is a tendency to make now nature writing in general a kind of nice product, you know, nice little books to buy and read and say, oh, that must be really interesting to, I better watch what I'm saying, because I don't want to criticize any individual, but to walk that trail or to raise that animal or something like that. It's going back to Ring of Bright Water country, which I don't really want to return to. What I do think is interesting is when people go out and say, don't listen to me, listen to the people I meet, because they know something about this land. I've spent a lot of time traveling in northern Norway and Finland and Sweden to some extent, but among Sami people, because I have Sami friends and I'm fascinated by Sami life. And I would, if I was writing something about Sami, I would just only want to quote what they were saying and not say anything about my impressions. I made a radio show which was unfortunately called Blueberries and Mandolin, although it was actually recorded in July when there's no blueberries. But all of it was Sami voices through it. And also people from the whole circumpolar area, because there's a circumpolar festival in northern Norway called Riddu Riddu, which you should, if it's still running, I hope it's still running next year, 2 years' time, it should go, it's wonderful. But it started as a Sami festival, became a circumpolar festival. And talking to people who know that their language is continuous with their land. This is the really important thing. Robert McFarlane's new book is somewhat about that idea, although it's rather...
What, landscapes?
Well, the idea that this new book about words, about the names, about place names and about the names for features. There have been two books came out recently in Britain about this subject matter. The fact that there are so many words for landscape features that most of us don't know anymore because we don't live in that relationship to land. Nils Aslak Valkeapää, the Sami poet, wrote a poem which is about the reindeer herders. And his translator said to him, how do I translate this poem into Norwegian and then English? Because Norwegians only have one word for reindeer, and the Americans and English only have one word for reindeer, and we have hundreds of words for reindeer. And he said, leave it in the original. Show them that they haven't got the vocabulary to take over our land and manage it for us, you know? And right now in northern Norway, for many years now, northern Norway, in Finnmark, I went to the Grunnlovsdag one time in the north, which is the National Independence Day, where everyone waves flags, and you can either wave the Norwegian flag or the Sami flag. And in several communities, they brought out white flags, and they waved white flags. There's a protest. That's the kind of gentleness of their protest, to say, you promised us, the Norwegian government promised, no more prospecting for minerals or oil, only one road through Finnmark, you know? And all of these things are happening, they're changing their minds about so many things. And so I want people who are writing about nature, whether poetry or prose, to go out there and say, don't look at me being in the landscape. I think some of our British writers, and some Americans, not many, but most of them in Britain, are about, hey, look at me having an adventure in, you know, climbing this mountain or walking across this desert. I'm more interested, we'll go out there and say, I'm just an ear and an eye. Let me listen. There's a wonderful new book coming out now, I think, called 60 Degrees, I want to plug this, 60 Degrees North by a guy called Maliki Talak, who's, are you know him? He's a Shetlander, and he decided, after his father died, and it was quite a hard part of his life, he decided to travel all the way around the globe at the 60 degree latitude.
60 Degrees by who?
Maliki Talak. I will spell his surname, T-A-L-L-A-C-K. He's a lovely man, and he's a wonderful writer. And he's all about that. His personal story is there, but it doesn't get in the way of the people that he meets and the people he talks to. And that's essential. If I had one thing I could do in this world, I would say, let's make a world council of indigenous people, and they would run the world for next 20, 50 years. Because they know, those people know, who live in a place, how to talk about it, how to manage it, how to safeguard it.
Like the old folk songs of the past, isn't it?
John.
Yeah. Mm. And when you look at music too, instead of buying what Sony mass produced for us, let's go out and find really great musicians. Michael Alpert, for example, everybody has heard Michael Alpert's work. When they do record him, his class is klezmer, but he's much wider than that, you know. And also, he's much deeper than the usual stuff you get. So that real folk music connects us to something. Yeah.
John, thank you so much. I was looking forward to this morning enormously anyway, but you have refreshed and stretched me, and I feel better informed about anything else, and you've introduced me to, and I expect all of us, to some poets who we didn't know. Thank you very much indeed.